139. And this one's going to be great because we had so many good stories. Murph, we had to turn this into four parts. So welcome to the four-part Game of Crimes. Players out there, welcome, amigos, amigos, players, pirates, dudettes, everybody in between. I am Morgan. You are who?
I am Murph, everybody. Welcome back.
Yeah, and this is going to be interesting because the reason we're making this a four-part episode, you players out there, is for one thing, our guest was extremely interesting. He had such fantastic stories from Afghanistan. And then the other thing too is Murph is departing. He's departing this continent. He's going to another, he's going out to the middle of the frickin' ocean for 10 days.
Yeehaw, going back to the South Pacific to the Federated States of Micronesia, specifically Chuuk. Yeah, looking forward to it. It's, you know, these things are, my wife thinks I'm an idiot, and I probably am, but to me, this is just an adventure.
How many people get to say they do something like this?
You're not kidding. And you know what? When I tell people about it, it doesn't matter who they are. They always, even when we were interviewing, Javier and I interviewed with Marcus Luttrell and his brother Morgan, and this was years ago, long before COVID, and they were asking all about narcos. And at the end, they're like, okay, we got one more topic we want to ask you guys about. What is this Lost Clipper thing in Amelia Earhart? And they were just really, really taken in by it. So it's an adventure, man. That's what it is.
It's not just a job. It's an adventure. Oh, that was the Army. I'm sorry. So you're too old to join the Army. Hey guys. Well, hey, real quickly, let's knock out our housekeeping, and we'll get into the case in chief, as they say in the legal profession. So head on over to Apple, Spotify, hit those 5 stars. We really appreciate it. Give us your comments too, guys. We love it. Even the bad comments, because I like it when people say bad things and mean things about me. We just use it for marketing and it really helps. But I prefer you to say nice things. Everybody says nice things about Murph. I'm the one that gets the bad things said about me. So, Murph, you're more popular than I am.
Well, I say a lot of bad things about you, so that probably covers for everybody else.
That does. Yeah, you do. All right. But, hey, also head on over to our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com, where you will see the book coming up from our guest, as well as some action shots, some action pictures coming over from Afghanistan when he was doing work there. Also, follow us on that thing they call social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. But where you absolutely have to be, you have to be on Patreon, patreon.com/Game of Crimes. And Murph, we just got through reviewing Along Came a Spider, the James Patterson novel that was turned into a movie starring Morgan Freeman.
Oh, yeah. I love that movie. I remember watching it a long time ago, but it had been so long ago, I had forgotten about the ending. So it was like watching it all over again.
Yes, and it's a good psychological thriller. Of course, our job is to talk about some of the technical inaccuracies in there, but overall, we really like the movie. But you're going to have to listen in, patreon.com/gameofcrimes, to see what we think about it. For those of you at our highest level, we've got our Warden of the Throne coming out, and then we've got things like 911, What's Your Emergency? We've had some interesting calls on those things. We've got our monthly Q&A, which we will get to for you folks listening who are members of Patreon. Our Q&A is going to come out a few days late. Why? Because Murph is going to be in the middle of the ocean, the Federated States of Micronesia, specifically Chuuk, looking for evidence that Amelia Earhart was held captive there.
Yeah, it's exciting, man. I just hope we find something now. I really do. There's a couple of reasons. One, so we change history. The other is so we get some of our money back.
Yeah, turn this into a TV show. Like we said, the worst thing in the world, that's why we were talking about maybe some of the networks and the other people didn't invest in it. Everybody remembers what happened with Geraldo Rivera and Al Capone's vault, the biggest burger on TV, I think, ever recorded.
Oh, yeah. So we're all out of pocket right now, and it's gotten in. I know Guy, I think he's over $200,000 that he spent. If you put us all together, everybody's involved in this, I'm sure it's well over $300,000 that's been invested in this. So be nice to get some of that money back, especially for Guy.
Hey, 7 come 11. Yeah, no, let's hope you get something there. So, but follow us on the thing. We'll have an update when Murph gets back. We'll do a special update on our podcast, not just Patreon, but on podcast, so you guys can see what happened with the Lost Clipper. Might even get Guy to come back on, depending on what you find out.
That'd be great.
So, but that's where you need to be. And also make sure you go over to Game of Crimes over on Facebook. Just type in Game of Crimes. Pull up the fan page run by our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, ruler with the iron fist with the velvet glove. We've got a lot of good people there, Murph. We got hundreds of people in that group, and we get some of our stories from there, our small town police blotter, our inspiration for some of the episodes. We've actually gotten some of the episodes based on what you people out there have told us to do.
That's right. You ask, and we try our best to deliver.
June Hawkins came from a request like that. That's what got you out of the doghouse eventually.
It did. It did. And now, you know, our good buddy Patrick O'Donnell is interested in getting her on his podcast. So we're making that happen for him.
And he's good. He's always good, Patrick. Your buddy out there, brother out there, is always good at trading. So he's got a guest for us. We got a guest for him. So hopefully we're going to get this lined up. Another certified bad guy. This one will be interesting.
Yeah, that if you're looking for another podcast, Patrick has Cops and Writers.
Yep,
and it's not all about writers, but he's an accomplished writer now as a retired police officer in Milwaukee. Is that right? Milwaukee, right?
Yeah, and it's not just writing reports like at 10:32 hours. Yeah. I was eastbound in my patrol vehicle when I spotted said suspect. No, he actually writes really good fiction. So you got to go check him out. Cops and Writers podcast.
Yeah, it's not like saw subject inebriated, arrested.
Saw drunk, arrested. Same. That's right. but head on over there. But also head on over to our fan page. But remember, folks, this is a show about crime. We talk about bad people doing bad things and bad people doing bad things to good people. We do take the story seriously, but what, Murph?
I know you've already figured it out. We never, never take ourselves serious.
Never take ourselves seriously. And as proof of that, we always reserve a section, and it's always time. Like you say, it's 5 o'clock somewhere. Guess what time it is, Murph? What time is it? Let me ask you, what time is it today?
It's time for
Small Town Police Blotter. All right.
Better at that.
This one comes from Kansas, Murph. Wichita, Kansas.
All right.
This one's going to make you... Ouch. Oh, this...
Do I need to stand up?
Oh, boy. I don't know. This one... A 39-year-old man was stabbed. Not only was he stabbed, he was stabbed with a hypodermic needle.
Okay.
The stabbing occurred during an argument with a needle wielder. So there's a funky way of saying it. The needle wielder. Mm-hmm. Cops believe the attacker is a female acquaintance or girlfriend of the man. Investigators reported that the victim, who was not cooperative, was admitted to St. Francis Hospital for surgery. So it was a serious stabbing. Uh-oh. What might you think a needle... Oh. A CAT scan showed part of an eagle broken off inside his scrotum.
Oh, God.
See, I told you it would make you wince. Ow!
Oh! I don't even want to think of that.
My gosh. That one, police have made no arrests with the stabbing, which has been classified as aggravated assault, a felony. It should be aggravated battery, too.
That brought tears in my eyes.
Just even thinking about it, it's like you're trying to sit down, you're going, ow, ooh, ow, ooh. It's going to hurt when you pee, son.
Oh, it's going to hurt when you do anything. Man, he must have really ticked her off.
Oh, boy. Get stabbed in the gonads with a needle, with a hypodermic needle. Oh, my God. And it's so hard that it breaks off, and you got to have surgery. Ouch. Okay.
Not to mention the painful, but how embarrassing.
You got stabbed where?
Okay. Well, you talk about shrinkage. Stick a needle in there.
All right, Murph, next one comes to us from Sonoma. By the way, Sonoma, you know, California wine region. But guess what? I didn't realize this. Sonoma is only 10,739 people. Salute. So, Murph, this is another one. A 53-year-old man who is visually impaired called cops in early May to report a bizarre encounter at his apartment. Mm-hmm. The man, whose name, for good reason, cops redacted from the report, said that an unknown female entered his home one Sunday. And he thought, you know, maybe she's with the doctors because he had just had a surgical procedure. And he thought maybe the doctor sent a woman to his house. Well, Murph, when's the last time you've had a stranger come to your house and said they need to give you an enema?
Oh, no, I don't think that's ever happened.
Well, the man thought this to be, he thought this to be somewhat strange. He did not think the enema was entirely out of the question, as he had undergone surgery on his intestines and assumed it may have been ordered by his doctor, even though he had not been notified. She guided him to the bathroom, where she had him lie face down on the bed with his pants pulled down. I got to tell you, folks, it's not the way you do an enema. Okay. She then gave the man what he presumed was an enema and immediately left. Talk about a hit and run. The man told cops that he was unsure and didn't want to do it, but that things happened so fast he didn't have a chance to object. I am so tired of hearing that, because it just happened so fast. How does it happen so fast that you're you go into the bedroom, pull down your pants, you bend over, and then all of a sudden, anyway. He described himself as befuddled by the events of May 1st. He says that if any question comes to your mind in the future, you know, make sure that it's legitimate. No arrests have been made, Murph, and it leads me to wonder. This really begs the question. Next time somebody knocks on the door, you know, they go knock, knock, you go friend or enema.
Oh, jeez. That's the only reason you told that story.
I was waiting to tell that one, yeah. Friend or enema?
Same thing. Enema, enemy. Okay, the same thing.
Enema? Okay. Jeez. Martha's down in your area, Largo, Florida.
Yeehaw.
Folks, if you're going to choose the consequences or the behavior, you also got to choose the consequences.
Oh, what happened?
And there are consequences for everything. So when they arrested Jeffrey Forrest Poole on charges of violently resisting a police officer, the authorities made it, you know, when you did the arrest report, Murph, what kind of things would you collect on the arrest report?
Well, you got to get all the basic information, but then if there's evidence that you're going to use, what you saw the person doing, if it's a misdemeanor, you have to have seen it. If it's a felony, you know, it's a different, it just depends on the case.
And just think about the arrest report itself. What kind of information about the arrestee would you collect?
Oh, all his personal identifying information, his description, what he's wearing. Does, you know, do you see any tattoos? Is any visible signs of a struggle in case he tries to claim, you know, something against a police officer beating later?
How about like nicknames and AKAs?
Yeah, that's part of it. What was his nickname?
This is inscribed for posterity.
It wasn't Needle Welder, was it?
No. Dick Face Johnson. That is his AKA listed forever on the police report. That is what his alias is.
Oh, that's not an endearing name, is it?
The name showed up because Poole was either asked if he had any aliases or had it, you know, filed anything under that name, and so the police marked it down, Dick Face Johnson.
He told him that. Again, there's a Rhodes Scholar.
If you're going to choose the behavior, you also got to choose the consequences, as Dr. Phil says.
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
All right, well, Murph, this next guest is interesting because it came to us a couple different ways. So I actually went down to a writer's event. And at that writer's, so it was at a club, and it was pretty cool because I got to meet Mark Greaney. So if you guys have ever listened to The Gray Man, Ryan Gosling plays him on the Netflix movie called The Gray Man. So I had a chance to go and sign up for this. And the guy I'm working with, Ryan Steck, knows Mark Greaney. So he sent a text down. I got to introduce myself. I'm talking. And then I meet this guy called Jeff Higgins. And I get to talking to Jeff. And he says, yeah, I used to be DEA. I said, no shit. You know Murph? He goes, yeah, I know Murph. I said, and he's written 11 books, so we got to get his book out. So, his book was launching. So I said, well, we got to get you on the podcast. And when we did, Murph, it was like, we got through that first story about Haji Bochco. And it was like, dude, we can't cut this short. We got to come back. So it's going to sound a little strange, but we've got four-part interview with Jeff Higgins. And, you know, you knew Jeff from back in the day.
Yeah, Jeff is Jeff was one of the two guys that opened the DEA office in Kabul, Afghanistan after 9/11. I think it was in 2003, maybe, when they did that. And they're going over there, I mean, starting from scratch. You know, it was funny because you'll hear him talk about the inspection team coming over and checking out their office. And that's all administrative crap. But, you know, I think they hadn't followed any of the rules. Well, it's Afghanistan, you know. It's not like working in the United States. But from there, he gets involved with DEA's FAST teams, and you'll just have to listen to the interview to find out more about those. But that's kind of like our SWAT team at that time. And ended up spending, what do you say, 5.5 years in Afghanistan?
Yeah, back and forth sometime there for quite a while, and then rotating back and forth on the FAST teams. They'd be over there for like 4 months, come back, you know, and then go back over.
And you guys, you know, from a previous episode, we had Joe Pierisanti over here, who was a DE agent that was on the FAST team, who was shot in the head when they were trying to extract. Extremely dangerous environment. And you just hear Jeff talk about it, and you can still hear the excitement in his voice. So he's experienced things that are similar to what I did, but I think his may have been a little bit more dangerous considering the environment that he was in. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, people ask us, why are we cops? You know, we love the excitement. We love the danger. That's an adrenaline rush that, you know, I'm sure military and first responders get it, but I'm not sure there's a whole lot of other occupations that provide that kind of adrenaline rush on a regular basis. You know, we're going to have Tim Mattson coming up here soon, who was a police officer in Pittsburgh who was shot. And you'll hear what he misses. But it's just great having Jeff on the show here. I'm so proud of his career after DEA. You know, a lot of law enforcement guys, they kind of go over and their security or their private investigators, contract security overseas, that kind of thing. But Jeff has really made something out of it. You know, with his writing career, and his wife's got Elaine's restaurant there, and that's Arlington, right? Arlington or Alexandria?
No, Alexandria. Yeah,
yeah. So this is an interview that I think you guys are really going to enjoy. That I mean, you got a full 4 hours coming up here. So, Mr. Dow, I know you get you a long trip because you got some good listening getting ready to happen, brother.
Well, this is going to be great, Murphy. And I'll tell you, like I said, it was so fun because he gave me the book and his book, and we'll talk about it, but I'll just give him a shout out now. You can go to his website, Jeffrey, J-E-F-F-R-E-Y, JeffreyJamesHiggins.com, and get his book called The Forever Game. It's about artificial intelligence. Really neat plot. And he's written 11 books now between short stories and this. So get his latest book, The Forever Game. But Murph, we will never find out about Mr. Higgins and all the work he did until I ask you. Are you ready to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the game of crimes?
Why, yes, I am. So everyone get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. This is a knock it out of the park interview with Jeff Higgins.
Well, this one's every one of our episodes is going to be great. We always say this is going to be great, but this is going to be great for two reasons. Number one, because this was serendipity. I show up to a book signing event, and who do I see at this book signing event? It's the guy I went down to meet, the guy I'm working with, and Mark Greeny. But then I meet this guy. This guy seems interesting. He's running a restaurant. I'm going, this dude's too sophisticated to be running a restaurant. Then to come to find out as I talk with him, he's former DEA. He's written a bunch of books. And by the way, I apologize for this in advance, Jeffrey Higgins, but your wife is very interesting. She is.
Oh, wait a minute. Where are you going with this?
More interesting than anybody I met that night, except maybe for Mark Greeny. So I'll tell you what, they got it going on. Well, first of all, let's welcome him to the show, Jeffrey James Higgins, author extraordinaire, former DEA and Hillsborough County.
Woo-hoo! Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here with you guys. You guys are legends in the community, so it's so much fun to chat with you.
Legends in our own minds. There you go, brother.
Legends in something.
I know you serve Lebanese wine down at your restaurant, but have you been hitting that a little bit too hard before you got on this podcast?
You know, I probably have, yeah.
I don't make you a bad guy.
No. Hey, well, it was so fun because just a couple weeks ago, the guy that I'm working with, we've actually had him on our show too, Ryan Steck. He's got some books out, but he works a lot with the thriller authors, and he said, hey, Mark Greeny's going to be there. So I said, he said, hey, I'll introduce you. Had a chance to go meet Mark. Well, then I end up going to this very nice restaurant, which we're going to ask you about in a minute, Jeffrey. And I was, first of all, I got to tell you, Jeffrey, you ran an excellent event. First of all, I love the area. I love the way it was designed. And I love the fact that you're doing stuff for authors. So before we even get into a lot of that stuff, tell us real quickly about your restaurant, what you got going on there, and why you focused a lot on the writing community, the author community down there in the beautiful town of Alexandria, Virginia.
Yeah, thanks for asking. Yeah, it's Elaine's restaurant. It's located at 208 Queen Street in Old Town Alexandria. So it's like the historic district. We're a block from the water. From the end of our block, you can see the Capitol. And really,
do you get flooded?
You know, we don't because there's a little bit of a hill going down.
Yeah,
but that park is Founders Park right at the end of our street, and that gets flooded sometimes.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, I'm not a restaurateur. It's my wife's thing. This was her dream. It's named Elaine's after her grandmother. My wife told her grandmother when she was 12 years old, she said someday she'd have a restaurant and name it after her. You know, so that's really her thing. So she renovated the place. She did our interior decorating. She is the heart and soul of that. I'm really just the hired help at this point.
Well, you did an excellent job being master of ceremony. So why did you focus on the writing community down there in Alexandria with your restaurant? Because you've got events going on all the time there. I mean, when I took a look at this, I said, how did I not know this?
Yeah, we're doing sometimes lately, we've been doing about 4 a week. So we have a lot of events going on. And honestly, I've been a full-time writer since 2017, other than what I'm doing with the restaurant. And we seat 120. And I'm like, this is a place where we can just give people a space to celebrate their books. You know, as I know a lot of former law enforcement guys are writing books and they have this image in their head, right? You write that one book, it's an amazing story and you're going to make $1 million. It really doesn't work like that.
Not at all.
And even trying to find a place, you know, to get together, you go to a Barnes & Noble, maybe, you know, a dozen people show up or something. Like, it's just not, it's not the same. So, you know, we have good food and liquor and the beautiful space. So that's what I've been doing. I've been running literary events and just trying to, give authors a place to get together with friends and family and, you know, put out some pictures. And honestly, I've really been honored to interview probably maybe over 50 authors at this point. Had a lot of New York Times bestsellers in there. We've had local authors. We've had poets and children's authors. My thing is, I'll never say no to an author. If they're looking for a space, we'll give it to them.
Nice.
Yeah, and it's great little space too. And that's what I say when I was checking it out, because I'm checking it out. Where's the, you do your recon, and Google Maps is a great way to do recon. Where's the parking and everything? Well, it was for 38 years, it was called Bilbo Baggins. And that's back before Lord of the Rings was, you know, popular and everything. So, I mean, but still, like you say, a historic area. That's such a beautiful area down there.
Yeah, we lost the Hobbit theme. I can tell you that. I can tell you. We painted over the Hobbit murals, and it's a little more elegant now. But we still have a lot of the same crowd still comes in.
Well, and we'll be referencing this too. So if you guys want to go check this out, you got to go to Jeffrey James Higgins, J-E-F-F-R-E-Y, JeffreyJamesHiggins.com. We're going to talk about your book, The Forever Game. It's your latest one that comes out. You've got several books out that we'll talk about, but The Forever Game is one that you've got out. You even got a blurb, like we said, from the guest of honor that night, Mark Greaney. How did you come across Mark Greaney?
Mark is such a generous guy. You know, I mean, a lot of authors who live in that thriller space are just that. I mean, they're all readers first, right? So they want other people to put out good books so they have something to read too. But, you know, you can imagine how many blurb requests somebody like Mark Greaney gets every year. And so I was really fortunate. I met him at Thriller Fest. There's a ITW's International
Up in New York, yeah.
Yeah, it's in New York every year. It's and their Thriller Fest is their annual conference. And it's like the who's who of thriller writers, you know? So it's thriller, mystery, some horror, kind of all the subgenres of thriller. And I just bumped into Mark and, you know, chatted with him. And he seemed like such a great guy. And so that's actually a really good way, by the way, for writers in your audience to get into the community and start meeting people and, you know, be part of that community, help other people out, you know, up and down the ladder. Everyone's on a different place in that journey of writing and publishing. And where, you know, so I think it's a good lesson. Wherever you can help somebody out, try to do it. And that's what we're doing through our restaurant.
And I took his advice too. So I'm going to go up there, and he said, volunteer 1 year, at least volunteer. So I'm going to volunteer up there, but I'll give him credit for something too, because he's a big guy, you know, in terms of publishing, he's got a lot of books out. So I just used his email, which you can find off his Facebook page. I just emailed him, and just as a follow up, hey, thanks for, I appreciate Ryan introducing us doing this. 2 days later, he responds, you know, he wouldn't have had to. I figured it was just going to go into a spam bucket somewhere, but the dude replied. So, you know, kudos to him for doing that.
Yeah, there's a good lesson in that too for authors. Like, you need readers, you know? And so when people reach out to you, try to respond to them. I always do too. I'm sure I don't get the same amount of mail as Greeny.
And it doesn't have to be a novel, but even a 2 lines. Hey, it was great to meet you. Good luck with what you're doing. Sincerely, Mark. Boom, that was it.
Yeah.
Made my day.
He's a great guy. I really had a good time interviewing him. I've interviewed so many authors there, and it's always interesting to talk to people about, you know, where they think story comes from and what their process is like, and, you know, how craft issues and what they do, because everybody's different. Like, and it is really fascinating. I like to ask people questions that they've never had before too. Make them think a little bit and try to get into their heads. So it's fun. It's fun for readers to come to and watch this.
I tell you what, Jeff, I've not seen Morgan fangirl over anybody since we had Steck here on the show. So,
oh, please,
that's a compliment to you, man. Watch out. He's going to cut your grass. You know, he'll take you places.
Well, I'm living in a condo, so the grass thing is going to be a little treacherous for you.
You got to do the whole grounds.
Yeah. No, I just appreciate somebody like you. Well, and we're going to get into this because you came out of a law enforcement, like I said, a background. So let's do this. Let's, as we always do with everybody, Cosa Nostra, thing of ours. How did you get started in this thing of ours? Jeffrey James Higgins, author, DEA, you know, Hillsborough County. How did you get started in this? Were you just like walking down the street one day in Boston and you get accosted by somebody and said, hey, I want you to park my car, and you stole it? I mean, what happened there?
There were no stolen cars. Not that I want to admit anyhow on the podcast. No,
that's not a denial.
Into it. I always wanted to be a writer, you know, and it was something that I never thought, like, you know, a lot of people grow up wanting to be a cop, wanting to get into it. And I didn't. I wanted to be a journalist and a writer. And then I was actually out of college. My undergrad was in journalism, and I was a reporter, a news reporter, and then I was a news editor, and I was interviewing cops. And I was like, you know, I'd get so excited when they tell me their stories. I'm like, this is great.
Where'd you go to school at?
I was at Boston University, was my undergrad, and then University of Cincinnati for my master's in criminal justice. But I just got into it, and then I thought it was really interesting. And between reporter jobs, I took a job working for a private investigator firm. And honestly, I was like a big Robert Parker, you know, the Spencer series, big fan of his. And I was thinking, oh, this will be great, you know, work as a PI, get some fodder for my books, and it'll be exciting. And then all of a sudden, I was surrounded by people who were in law enforcement, you know, and I really respected what they were doing. These were guys who were trying to make the world a better place and putting themselves out on the line and, you know, literally risking their lives. And I did that for a while, and that rolled into me wanting to be a cop. And I still, in the back of my head, I was like, I will write books, but I wanted to go try that for a little bit. So I went to the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office in Florida.
Why Florida? Why not stay in Boston, you know, or somewhere around there, Northeast, where you were, you know, you're from?
So this was early 90s, and there were law enforcement freezes all over New England because of the economy at the time. And I mean, I looked everywhere, and there were, you know, other challenges too, to trying to get hired. But I applied to a dozen places. I was looking all over the country, and the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office is a professional outfit. I think they were the third largest sheriff's office in the country at the time. And, you know, it looked like a good place to be and go try it. Maybe I'd watch too much like Miami Vice, but
there we go again.
That seems to be the common connector between everybody that goes into narcotics. We all watch Miami Vice.
Other than we just had June Hawkins on, like we said, from the detective from Griselda. She started before Miami Vice was a thing, so she was OG back before it was Sonny and, you know, Crockett and Tubbs. But when you went down to Florida, did you have offers from anywhere else? Did you apply federally, or was that like the first one that came through and you took it?
You know, I'd applied to DEA, and they had a hiring freeze right when I was in the hiring process, which is probably, you know, it's good timing. But I'd applied to a bunch of departments, you know, and I was getting listed and things. But, I took the first offer from a decent department I got, and that was from Hillsborough. And I went down there, and I liked it. I was really fortunate. I don't know about you guys, but you like look back over your career, and I just got to do so much fun stuff, so much, you know, exciting stuff. So working for so many different groups, kind of a unique experiences, and the guys I got to work with, I still keep in touch with guys, you know, that I was in the academy with in Hillsborough, in Tampa, you know, back in 92. You know, and so I started in patrol. I went to auto theft task force. I was in street crimes. I ended up in the organized crime bureau doing narcotics work. You know, I mean, really, really fun stuff. And each for people trying to get into law enforcement too, like each one of those jobs I could have done for a whole career. You know, like patrol is the place where most people start, but patrol is one of the coolest jobs in law enforcement. You know, I know there's new challenges now, certainly, you know, and there's a lot of liability and other issues, but, you know, I mean, I got into a shooting while I was in my field training program. So I was like in my first couple of weeks.
Well, you can't just gloss over this and say, let's not bury the lead, because I had that note here when we talked about it earlier. So set the stage for that. I mean, you are, first of all, when you went through, how many people were in your class approximately, if you remember?
I don't remember, but not a lot, probably 30 something, you know, I mean, they were hiring, but it was back then there was a lot of competition to get on, which I'm, you know, now I think I know a lot of places are looking to hire and they're trying
to lower
their
if you had a class of 30 now, that would be called a huge class, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Everybody's understaffed, right? I was just talking to something in Arlington, which is, I'm in Alexandria, Virginia. Arlington, Virginia is right opposite DC. And they're down like a huge number of officers. Like, I don't know how they're even going to field enough people in patrol at this point, you know? So it was a very different time.
Yeah, the guy that used to be the chief down there, Jay Farr, been a friend of mine for a long time. He retired a couple years ago, but that's he's kind of like Nick Saban. You kind of see something going coming, and you go, you know, punch out. Well, let's talk about this though. So you go through this. So you guys go through the academy. About how long's your academy? 6 months? 16 weeks?
There were two. So we went through the Florida Academy, which all law enforcement officers in Florida go through, and I think that was about 4 months. Ish, you know, it's been a long time and I'm old now. So about 4 months. And then we had to go through a Hillsborough County specific academy at the end of that, which I believe was only a few weeks or a month or something. So, you know, it wasn't that long.
But yeah, that's what I'm saying. So you've been in training for a whole time. Now you're out with your FTO, you're starting to train. Had you dealt with weapons before? Had you done a lot of shooting, hunting or anything? Or was this like your first exposure to weapons?
Yeah, no, I wasn't a hunter, and I'd shot weapons before, and I had some pistols, and you know, I'd shot rifles and things. But no, it's a very different thing too, right? When you're carrying a gun on your hip, and I mean, it's like a rookie when you first get that thing, you're like checking it with your elbow all the time to make sure it's still there. You know? it is very different carrying a gun. And then I mean, I worked in like three distinct neighborhoods, and the first one was kind of upper class. This is when you go through field training, you know. So I was in this upper class neighborhood. It was kind of wealthy. And ironically, that's where I got into the shooting. Right. And then I went to more of a gang neighborhood. There was a lot of Hispanic gangs and I was a gang coordinator. And then I ended up in just the poorest part of town. I volunteered for these midnight shifts in the projects, you know, and that's where people really need to figure out what they're doing fast. And it was super exciting.
Well, let's go back to your training. So, you said you were a couple weeks into training with your FTO when this happened.
Yeah, you know, in a wealthy kind of neighborhood too. So even working like a night shift, the stuff we were doing wasn't that, you know, it was a lot of domestics and that kind of thing. And we got a call for a loud party. Because when you're in training, they'll try you in the day shift, they'll try you in the evening shift, they'll try you in the night shift. They give you a little exposure to everything. And so this was like a party going on. It was a barbecue, and there was a neighbor who had been drunk and belligerent. So, you know, it's about as boring a call as you can probably get. And full moon though, which as you guys probably know, it's selective memory, right? But it seems like every time that happens, the crazies would come out. But my partner and I arrived at this thing, and we, you know, we're talking to people, and they're like, oh, this guy was causing problems and yelling, and he lives right down the street, and he walked down there with a daughter of the people who are having this party. And so my partner and I were just walking down the street to talk to this guy. You know, it was a public disturbance. It's literally misdemeanor stuff, you know, just in, you do the informal policing where you just tell people to be quiet. You try not to go make arrests and bring the judicial system into play.
Which means you're trying to do your best to avoid paperwork. Nobody wants paperwork unless it's absolutely necessary.
Yeah, you know, and it's also that's how most conflict gets resolved, right? Except for there's laws for domestics and things. If you go there and there's signs of abuse or there's signs
mandatory, you have to do mandatory things now.
Exactly. Which is probably the right thing, right, for domestics. So, you know, I think that is a good rule. But for everything else, you know, I mean, even minor crimes, a lot of times you can just solve it with warnings, and you can talk to people and make sure it doesn't happen again.
That's called officer discretion. That's not allowed too much anymore.
No. Well, I mean, now you've got a lot of people in patrol who are sitting in their cars, not doing anything proactive, you know, which is part of the reason we have these rising crime rates. I think DC homicide rates are up like 180% or something right now. I mean, it's really bad. And you're seeing that. I mean, what do you expect, right? You call all cops racist. You say all cops are doing the wrong thing. And then you charge people for doing the job as they were trained to do it, you know, when they're defending their lives. I mean, we've seen this all over the country. I've actually written a bunch about this. And using like a Washington Post shoot, which is, you know, kind of a left-leaning paper, but using their shooting database and all government sources, you know, and so I've done the analytics on it, and you know, just to shoot down these narratives that cops are like out there hunting minorities and killing people improperly. You know, it's just not. It happens, but it's so rare. With, you know, 700,000+ law enforcement officers in the country, and every year there's a handful of bad shootings. You know, like literally, in a lot of them are very few. Every now and then there's like one blamed on racism, but generally not. Generally, it's just a bad shooting, but there's a handful every year. Maybe you know, 20 plus like unarmed blackmail shot. And when you
when you consider that hundreds of thousands of police interactions a year, that the number of people who die from that, no, you don't want anybody to die, but it's less than the people who die from malpractice. It's less than the people who die from a variety of other things. And yet, yeah, you're right. It's a public trust. And look, we could go down a whole rabbit hole on that, but I'm going to bring us back to your shooting. So let's talk about your shooting. So it's the typical, it's a typical call. You know, it's like they say, it's the routine traffic stop. It's the routine stop. It's a full moon. So what goes sideways on you?
Like that's patrol, right? Like you just never know. And that is one of the coolest things on patrol. Like, you know, you could be sitting having the most boring night ever. And then that you're with these terminals, these DXTs in our car, they beep with a call and you could literally be fighting for your life like 5 minutes later. Like it's super exciting. But so we're at this call for a disturbance and my partner and I, we parked, we're walking down the street. We're walking up to this house where this guy, this drunk guy who is causing a problem is, and he's out front with this girl, the girl from down the street. And as we approach, he lifts up a gun and shoots her right in the head and kills her right in front of us.
Holy like, shit. Oh, man. You know, but,
and so my partner and I were walking up the driveway. The guy turns and points his gun at us and we split. And I went one way, my partner went the other. And I moved up along the side of the garage. I mean, I remember this so vividly, right? Because this is like a few weeks into training. You're like, oh, I guess this is what we're doing out here, you know? And as I was coming up, the guy was getting a bead on my partner who was trying to hide behind a car. And so I drew my gun, pointed it at him, and he pulled back behind the garage. So literally the only target I had was his hand and the gun. And I shot at him and I missed. And I'm going to tell you something, which people tell me cannot happen, but I swear to God it happened. I saw my bullet go over his hand. And, you know, that it's just going too fast. You just can't see that. But I did, you know, and I just missed him. The shot went off. He pulled back and then he ended up throwing out his gun and we took him into custody and he was convicted for this murder. But, you know, that moment when you have your first shooting, and I've been in a bunch of them now, you know, like over the course of my career. That first one, though, you know, my hearing shut down. The sound of my gun going off was like a dull pop.
You know, auditory exclusion.
Yeah, auditory exclusion. And I had the tunnel vision, you know, everything that you read about. But I had it all because this is literally you're bordering on that fight or flight, right, response. And I saw nothing but that gun. And I swear I saw my bullet go over his hand.
Well, but the mere fact that here you are a youth, you know, a rookie, just not that, you know, far out of training, but even though you got as close as you did to getting his hand, you know, with just his hand and weapon out there, look at it this way. People think use of force means you got to hit something. No, sometimes even firing and missing, if that solves the problem, that's an acceptable use of force. And so but you know, that has got to be kind of a defining moment in a police career where one of the first calls you go to, there's nothing you can do about it because somebody pulls out a gun and they shoot somebody in the head. There's no way you can react as fast as that person can.
Yeah, especially, I mean, even if you're really alert and paying attention, I mean, you're talking about a second and you're walking and you have to see the threat, get your gun out. Like it just happened. You know, he was partially blocked from our vision. So we had no warning that he was about to do that. But, you know, then after the shooting, I had all of those feelings that a lot of cops have. I remember people go into law enforcement because they want to help, right? You get that one out of 1,000 who's probably a psychopath who wants to just, you know, lord himself and the authority over other people. But everybody else is literally there risking their lives trying to help people. And so, you know, when you shoot at someone or you kill somebody, like it's traumatic, you know? So afterwards, right, we get the guy into custody, you know, they send everybody, you know, the shoot team comes out and everything. I'm sitting in the back of a car with the door open just because they're like, stay away from everybody, don't talk to anybody, you know? Suddenly it's like you're the criminal, you know? And they take your gun from you and the shoot team comes out. And so I'm having all those feelings, you know, like, oh, did I need to shoot? Was that the right thing? You know, and that's why it's really important, I think, especially when there's police unions and things to keep officers who are involved in this, give them time to decompress a little bit. I mean, my partner at the time, he was my field training officer, right? He was like, oh, my God, you saved my life. You know, for years, he would just reach out to me and send me clips from like the radio calls and things from that. So it was a big deal for him.
But, you know, and a lot of times people forget, you just hit it upon the head. I was involved with a friend of mine, and it's funny because he reached out to me over LinkedIn and said, hey, I heard my name on a podcast. Well, it was a guy named Harold Milarms. And when this shooting happened, we both were assigned to the same district, the same house. I'm showing up right after the shooting happened. But when they brought him back to the police department, one of the smart, and I give them credit, one of the smart things they did, even though the KBI, Kansas Bureau of Investigation, had to take his weapon, first thing the chief did, a guy named Roger Schrader, got him another weapon, got it loaded back into his holster, and made him whole again, right? So you don't want, to your point, I think that happens too often, is that you take somebody's weapon away, it's almost like, what, am I a criminal? The other thing you mentioned too about even having some kind of representation, I'm going to just take a wild guess based on your own statement, but that's the first shooting you were involved with. You had no idea what was going to come. You had no idea what was going to go on. You needed the experience of union reps or other people who've been through this, you know, dozens and dozens of times to help steady you, you know, through this whole court process, because it was a process. How long did it take before they cleared everything and you're back to like regular duty?
It was pretty fast. I want to say about a week. Like it was pretty fast.
Because nobody was, you guys didn't end up shooting anybody. I mean, it was just a discharge of a weapon, but no injuries, no fatalities, at least on your part.
Right, right. Yeah, I didn't kill anyone. But, you know, it was a murder and it was happening in front of us and there were plenty of witnesses. And so it was about as clear cut as you can get. But, I mean, we've seen that even recently, though, where good shootings are on tape and cops have been raked over the coals for it, you know, so it does happen. Not to go back into fighting this media narrative, but I thought I'd mention it.
We have an episode coming out. We were just talking about, we don't want to give it away, but here's a guy who the shooting was captured on body camera. The perp gets out of the vehicle firing at the officers. Boom, boom, boom. He goes to trial and guess what? Found not guilty.
Three body cams and a car dash. And that wasn't enough.
Yeah, no, I mean, I did this a couple years. I think it was 2016 or 2017, then again in like 2019. I analyzed every shooting with an unarmed suspect in police, every single one of them, and they're almost all good shootings, you know. And even when they say unarmed suspect, a lot of times it's a suspect trying to get the police officer's gun.
That's a misnomer.
Or he was just shooting at him, and then he drops his gun as he's being shot. I mean, you'd be shocked at what they're calling unarmed shootings.
Or when you've got a 250-pound guy choking out a 120-pound female officer, and her last act of self-defense is to fire, you know?
Right, right, right. It's just, and if people knew the facts, that's why I wrote these articles, really data-driven articles, so people can see the numbers for themselves. And it is something like 10 million arrests, you know, with a handful of unarmed people shot. And of those, almost all of them are good.
Yeah. Well, but there's a whole nother episode, so we're going to get back to our regularly scheduled podcast.
I'm usually the one that gets on the soapbox.
I love that.
But you know what, though? I get it, and we won't talk about it anymore, but I can't help it because, I mean, these are guys out there risking their lives for the public. Yep. They're not making a lot of money. This is a hard, hard job. They're making split-second life and death decisions, and then they're getting persecuted unfairly. Like, if a cop is racist or if a cop is corrupt, everybody wants them to go to jail or be fired, or, like, everybody.
What do we always say? We always say nobody hates a bad cop more than a good cop.
I mean, that's so true, but the narrative you're hearing is just a lie. You know, it's just a lie.
We're with you, brother.
Well, and we're not talking about getting off the soapbox. I'm just saying, I'm just looking at it going, this could be a whole nother, and actually it should be. We had Chris Presser on here from ATF. Chris is doing the same thing, looking at shootings in Chicago, where he's at, and the same thing doing. Look, it's in the numbers. Heather McDonald wrote a great book called The War on Cops and gets into the numbers and everything, just to your point. So let's talk about how this, you know, you were, and this is, like you said, the early 90s, right, when you started?
Right. I went through the academy in 92.
So you're just out, you're still wet behind the ears, so to speak, in a law enforcement sense, you get into a shooting. So, you know, where does it go from there? I mean, like you say, it's only about a week, you're back on the job. Does that change your worldview about what you think about policing now? Does that change anything about the way you want to approach the job or the things you get into now that because you're involved in a, you know, use of force situation so early on?
You know, that's a great question. I part of the reason, I mean, I wanted to be a cop to do good things, but the excitement was a huge draw, right? Like going out there and fighting bad guys. I mean, I think especially with men, but women too, you have this need to protect people, you know, and it's when there's bad people doing things to innocent people, you just want to step in and do something. And, you know, you could talk to probably everybody who joins the military. That's why they got into it. You know,
they're sheepdogs.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so that's a huge part of it. And then the actual excitement itself and the adrenaline rush and right and doing things that are meaningful. But I think getting into a shooting early on made me realize, you know, that the life and death stakes that are there. And I mean, that's an early introduction to the evil that's in the world, right? Just killing people for no reason. And so I went to a heavy gang area. And then, you know, and I was fighting all the time and getting into like, you know, worse and worse kind of calls. And then I volunteered for literally the highest crime area in the area. It was bordering the city of Tampa. They called it Suitcase City because of the transient nature of the place. And, you know, I'm in there with, and I mean, getting, you know, you're getting calls for rapes, getting calls for murders. You know, I was getting into a good vehicle, pursuit probably once a month. You know, we were getting, I was in like a violent resist arrest at least once a week. You know, it was just a good area to be a cop, you know, and you develop strong bonds with the other officers, you know, and these are good guys. And we were doing some really good work, and, you know, you're helping people. I mean, people forget this too. Like, you look in these like high crime areas, the people that are suffering most are the overwhelming majority of citizens who live in those high crime areas, you know?
And those are the ones that want the cops in there the most. They don't want fewer cops. They want more cops.
Yeah. Right. I mean, they need more cops, right? And they just, you know, just because of like a racial or other demographic difference doesn't mean they're higher crime areas for whatever reasons that are there, you know, and it's poverty and childless, fatherless homes. And there's all these other variables that impact it. But in those areas, most of the people there, you know, 95% of the people in there are good people. It's actually career recidivists who do the majority of crime, you know, violent crime. And the only theory that really works is incapacitation.
Well, they just got through looking at all the crime that's going on in New York right now. They analyzed 1,000 crimes that happened. 38 people were responsible for like 92% of those 1,000 crimes.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds right. Like, even when I worked on the Auto Theft Task Force, we were going after chop shops and we were going after serial car thieves who were working for them. And a handful of thieves were responsible for most of the car thefts. But it's more important. That's property crime, right? It's more important when you're talking about, you know, violent crime. And there's a lot of places. Like, I had a friend who was with LAPD, and they would just go after these career recidivists. They would follow them around until they did something else again.
Yeah, there was a special unit at LAPD, might have got into a little bit of trouble, maybe made a Michael Connelly novel.
That's
I have
right.
No recollection of that, Your Honor.
What are you talking about? I got, you know, hey, this guy's walking down the street, he trips and falls, not my problem. You know what I mean?
What's Rampart? I don't even understand what that means. Rampart.
But there are, I mean, there are things that work. And so my master's was in criminal justice with a focus on research, right? And so there are things that are actually proven to work, like problem-oriented policing, where you bring all the resources of a community to bear, you know, going after career recidivists, like incapacitating them. If they're in jail, they're just not hurting the public, right? And you don't want people going to jail for nonviolent crimes for long periods of time, unless it causes nonviolent crimes, right? You don't want to arrest people for silly stuff. But that's not who's in prison. The people who are in prison, you know, even if it's like just like a drug possession offense, that's like their 50th crime or whatever, it's always something that was pled down. You know, there's always violence associated. There's always other bad crimes. So, you know, that's when you're working in a high crime area like I was. I mean, you're going after people who everyone's got, like, you know, the 50 crimes, and, you know, all the people that you're coming into contact with who are hurting other people in that community are just bad people.
Well, and then you hear these stories about like some of the people involved in shooting and killing officers. They've got 5, 10 felonies, prior felonies. You've got people now. I mean, I know people are not going to get upset. They're illegal aliens. It's a legal definition. They're here illegally. The Constitution refers to them as aliens. But you've got an increased number of people in being involved in serious crimes, you know, like Lakin, not Lincoln, Lakin Riley down in Georgia, you know, and it's just, to your point, you know, the other thing that's the change is, I think what's changed from the time that we were into where it is now, it's also in the morals of society. When I was growing up, I told this story before. When I was 16 years old, I got stopped by a state trooper. I think it was, I peed my pants. I was so scared of authority. It's kind of like, but now it's like, they put out TikTok videos and videos out there where people are openly taunting the cops and doing stuff in front of their face. So much has changed between then and now. Look, self-discipline, self-rule doesn't work without self-discipline, as Paul Harvey said. So, man, I think we've gotten away from so much of that. There's just not enough self-discipline in society.
So, you know, people get they believe what they see in the media, right? They believe what they're told. People are just living their lives. They don't have time to look into the data. They don't have time to look. So they're easily manipulated in a lot of ways. And this is regardless of political affiliation, right? Everybody's kind of like this because you don't have time for it. And they're just the narratives that are out there are just wrong. They're just lies, you know? And if people believe that like all cops are racist, all cops are corrupt, all cops are doing the wrong thing, then you can understand why there's a, why they act like the way they want to resist and they don't trust the police and whatever. But they're being told one thing, and there's a small cadre of political actors that are behind it who just want to destroy the institutions of this country. And I mean, they will tell you that. They openly admit it. That's what they're trying to do. And when they push, that's why they're pushing these narratives. And unfortunately, a lot of the media goes along with it for whatever reason. And so they just perpetuate these lies. And it's been really bad for law enforcement. I mean, I wrote about this in 2016, where I predicted this lack of people, like good recruits, having to reduce, you know, I mean, this has happened in other places, right? It happened in Miami and like the 90s or the late 80s. You know, if you drop your standards, the people you get coming in as police officers will not do as good a job.
Right.
And the people who suffer most are poor people who are living in high crime neighborhoods.
And let me tell you who nailed this. It's when Walter Isaacson, I think, wrote the bio about Steve Jobs. And Steve Jobs actually had it nailed. He said, look, A players want to work with A players, but B players end up hiring C players, and pretty soon you've got the bozo explosion. To your point, I think you could make a case to say I would rather have fewer officers that met our standards than hire more officers where a percentage of them didn't meet our standards and we're simply trying to fill seats. Because to your point, then you start looking at what happens from an internal investigation standpoint, what happens from a liability standpoint, what happens from a community standpoint. I think the risks and the costs are far greater, but to them, success is about the process. Well, we hired 10 officers. I would rather hire 3 officers that are going to meet this. I don't care who they are, male, female, name it. As long as they meet the standards, they meet the training, they meet the ethical guidelines, they pass the background, rather than hiring 10 simply because we need 10 cops.
Standards are standards for a reason, right? And if you don't need to reach that standard, then the standard was wrong to begin with. But if you're lowering it below your minimum standard, you will have problems.
You know, and the media puts it out there because, I mean, this is private industry. They're in it to make a buck. And the more viewers they get, the more advertisers they get. So they're willing to put, you know, whether they put their spin on it or not, which seems like most of them do, they're still going to put it out there, whether it's true or not. Well, this is what we were told, you know, and here's our source. And so therefore, we're putting it out here to bring in the viewers, to bring in advertising dollars. It's all about the buck. Make another buck.
And what's the old saying? You know, that's too being a report. If it bleeds, it leads, right? So.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, let's get back to our regularly scheduled podcast. This is fun. We've got all sorts of sideline diversions here. But let's talk about your transition, because you said at one time you applied for DEA. Why? You know, and what made you go back and apply again? Because eventually you end up on DEA.
Yeah. So it was just the proactive nature of narcotics enforcement. You know, there's a lot of reactive police work, but going out and running stings and doing undercover and, you know, it just seemed like it was a lot more interesting. It was a lot more stimulating, a lot more difficult in a lot of ways, right? When you're crafting a sting or you're working undercover, there are a lot of moving pieces to that. And I thought that was more fun than sitting back and waiting for a crime to occur and then trying to investigate it. So I'm a thriller writer now, as opposed to like a mystery writer. And now that you mention this, I'm thinking that's it exactly, right? A classic mystery is a crime is at the beginning and then you spend the whole book trying to solve it. A thriller is you're trying to prevent something horrible from happening.
A thriller is shit's about to happen, and every page you're trying to do your best to keep it from happening. It's not like, well, who's the killer going to be? Dude, I got a nuclear bomb about to go off, or somebody's about to blow up the president. We got to do something now.
Exactly. So now that I think about it, that's sort of the same thinking when I chose where I wanted to be in law enforcement.
Yeah, that is a great analogy. That's yep. Good. You could either be a mystery writer, like work for the FBI, or be a thriller writer and work for the DEA.
Yeah, there you go. DEA did some, you know, I mean, that level and that type of law enforcement, like I ended up doing, I spent most of my career doing like counterterrorism work, right? So going after terrorist organizations and things, but that the protocols and the strategies that drug enforcement officers use, right? Whether even on local levels or whatever, that works so well and it's so effective because you're getting proof of crimes in progress, you know, and you're going after people that are committing crimes, especially people like in organized crime that are so far away from the actual like murder happening that they're difficult to charge, right? So those drug techniques, those counter drug techniques worked so well in counterterrorism, and it was something I spent a lot of time trying to push DEA to do and to get more involved in counterterrorism.
Well, and a shout out to a buddy of ours too, and because we want to lead into this because your story about 9/11 really ties into why you end up in Afghanistan and other places. But we were talking with Zach Zaharashevitz. I got to get this name. I kept calling him Zaharashevsky one time, known like Manashevitz, but Zaharashevitz. But you know, so I think about cases like Victor Boot, which you told me when we were talking, Murph will have to find out he has a tie-in to Victor Boot. To the case, but you've got a 9/11 story, and that the reason I wanted to get into that is because that kind of sets the stage for things that you're going to be doing later in Afghanistan, going after Khan Mohammed and another gentleman by the name of Haji. Now, is it Bagcho or Bagcho?
Bagcho.
Bagcho.
Yeah, it's hard,
like
right?
Nacho or Bagcho?
Sure, go with, yeah. Haji Nacho.
Haji Baba. Actually, there's a great place in Turkey. I was doing stuff for the State Department, and they took us out to eat the gendarmes. But we went to Haji Baba's, had kunafe and Iskander. Great food. And then 2 months later, a guy blows himself up in front of the entrance to the consulate that we'd been walking in through. So go figure. Back to our regularly scheduled podcast. Well, let's talk about that. So how did you end up in New York with, when did you get on DEA and how did you end up in New York?
So I was a cop for about 5 years in Hillsborough. Then I joined DEA and I went to the academy in January of 97. So about a 4.5-5 month academy. And I volunteered for New York. Like the way DEA did it at the time, I think they still do it like this, is they'll come up with, okay, there's 50 people in the academy. Here's 50 slots, right? And so they let the agents pick their first three places. So I knew I wanted to get back to the Northeast because I'm from Boston. And New York was there, and I knew it would be one of my top three, so I figured I'd get it anyhow. So I just picked it number one. And what better place to learn the job than New York City, right? It was it's a transshipment location. It's a import location, right? There's violent criminals from all over the world that are in New York City, and so I figured that what a great place to learn the job. And it was. There were all the big organizations were there. You know, it was a first point for drugs to come in for a lot of places in the New York, all the way out to like Chicago. You know, there was all kinds of organized crime there. There were Colombian hit crews. There was a lot of good stuff to do in New York.
Well, and it's the home of Derek Maltz.
I knew Derek in New York, and I also ended up working for him at our Special Operations Division. So he was the sack of the SOD who welcomed me in there years later.
Oh yeah. He's piece of work now.
Yeah. But here's something you don't know. So when we had Derek on our podcast, Derek was talking about us when he was a kid, like 12 or 13 years old. His dad took him out on a couple raids because his dad was in DEA. And he actually said, I need you to go back on the radio. So his radio number was 10 and a half. His dad had Derek get on the radio. This is 10 and a half. We need this, you know.
I think it was Derek who told me this, but didn't his father take him out and like have him follow a suspect up in an elevator?
Yep. And tell us which apartment they go into and then report back.
Yep. That is, if that doesn't turn you into a special agent, I don't know what will.
Now, I can just imagine an operational plan being delivered now to, you know, to an ASAC somewhere. You're going, well, part of our strategy is we're going to use my 12-year-old son to go follow the suspect. Okay. Yeah.
You know what's interesting, right, though? That is DEA, right? Like right down to the core. Like it's mission focus. It's about getting the job done. It's maybe working in some gray areas and bending some rules. I swear, everything I did that really mattered over my career, I did because I was not really listening to what I was supposed to be doing, or I was telling people I'm going to do it anyhow. I mean, I lived in that gray area, and not legally, you know, but procedurally for most of my career.
You know, most DEA agents learn that, I mean, you're not violating the law, but when it comes to policies and procedures, you look at them as strong suggestions. And it's easier to ask for forgiveness than it is to ask for permission.
And you know, the other thing, it's easier to go execute on the mission than it is to file a memorandum that has to make its way up to headquarters and come back to you 6 weeks later. It's like, nah, screw that, you know?
Yeah. What I realize is in a lot of my writing, and I have three published books out now, but a lot of other ones, whenever it's law enforcement related, I always have my protagonist who's just breaking rules and doing his thing. But that was kind of my career. You know,
This is funny. Mine's just finally, I'm getting the first book done. I'm getting my editorial notes back. But funny you should mention that, because my protagonist, a detective with a secret CIA past, same thing, man. Just like you said, Murph, you know, policies are for wankers, you know?
That's a guideline, you know?
Well, you know, a lot of times somebody does something wrong, then they make a policy to prohibit anything around that that could cause that wrong thing from happening again. And it just doesn't apply.
So I can guarantee you in the Highway Patrol and on the police department, there are some new department policies that are because they hadn't thought about this before, and I brought it to their attention.
But you want your agents to be mission focused, too. You don't want them violating rights. You don't want them violating laws, but you do want them just getting the damn job
done. Get the job done.
You don't want them saying, "Oh, I can't because I haven't filed this form," or "I can't because this." I mean, I like the Khan Mohammed case, which was the first narco terrorism case, a precedent setting case under the 21 USC 960A. That first case, I literally had my supervisor telling me to drop the case. You know, and I'm like, yeah, okay. You know, like I wasn't going to do it. You know, like I knew it was important. You know, but it's like every big case I did, I had to go, you know, just get things done. And some of the stuff we did, you know, and this is why I love DEA, by the way. A lot of agencies are so top down driven, but DEA, the guy at the point of the spear is the agent. And so much of DEA is just at that group level where it's a supervisor and the agents or just the agents themselves, the case agents on a particular investigation making decisions. And that's why they're so effective.
Well, let's keep that thread going, but let's talk about Europe and New York. Tell us about your 9/11 story, because we got this. Zach was up there at DEA headquarters in New York. What about you? What was going on that day?
Yeah, so I was working in the New York division, and then I'd just gone to the task force where I was working with NYPD and the state police, and just a bunch of great guys, by the way. You know, it's in law enforcement, you just have that connection wherever you go. And I've worked with cops all over the world now, and there's always this. I mean, people, you see life as it is, you know, you understand the evil in people and the good in people, and you understand human nature. And working with the NYPD guys was fantastic, and the state police troopers was just terrific. But yeah, I hadn't gone in yet that day on 9/11, and I remember I was at the gym, and so I heard somebody say that a plane had hit the tower in New York. I was literally at the gym, and I went to the other room and watched it. And as soon as I saw it, I'm like, "That's terrorism, right?" A clear day, you know. And I remember the announcer talking about, "Oh, it could be navigational problems and all this." I'm like, "No, right?" So I used the phone at the gym, and I called in. I said, "What are we doing? What's our response?" And of course, the case agent was there. It's like, "What do you mean? There's no response. You know, it's just, you know, whatever, just business as usual." So I'm like, "Okay." So I jumped in a car, and I put on my lights and sirens, and I raced down as fast as I could. And when I was coming down, the second tower was hit. I was up in Connecticut at the time. I remember driving down the West Side Highway and seeing people streaming up the side of the West Side Highway between the river and the highway, thousands and thousands of people. It looked like a Godzilla movie, you know, like people just streaming, trying to get away from it. And the two towers, you know, smoking in the distance. And I remember the radio coming out when the tower came down too, you know. The NYPD guy came over the radio and said, the tower's gone. And they're like, can you repeat that? He's like, the tower, it's down, or, you know, words to that effect. But I got to our office, and I was, you know, there were a bunch of agents, and like DEA agents, right? They were like, "What do we do? How do we help? There's people dying. Well, let's get into the fray." But there was no direction from up above. There was no direction, you know, from any of the management. So a bunch of us, I think there were 12 or 15 of us, wrote our names and our beeper numbers. This is how long ago this is, right? On a piece of paper, and left it at base. And we just jumped in cars and drove down there. And when we got down there, the tower had just come down, the North Tower. And, there was so much dust and just debris in the air. And I remember we parked a few blocks away, probably 10 blocks away. And then I was walking down, and we met some of the NYPD PD guys. And there was a captain there, and there was one of the fire captains was there. And I remember saying, "Hey, what do you do? What's the response?" And the guys was like, "I don't know. My guys are all in there." You know, like that hadn't happened before. You know, the communications were wiped out because the cell phone towers were on the Trade Center. There was this huge loss of life and all the first responders that were lost. So the, you know, chains of command were wiped out. And so I walked down with another agent, and I said, "Let's just go down there and see if we can help." Like there's no active response at this point where we were. So we just walked down, and at one point I ended up by myself. I remember just walking through the through this dust. There were flames shooting out of cracks in the ground. You know, I was walking down one of the streets, and a car blew up, just fully engulfed next to me. You know, it was like out of a horror movie. And I'm walking down. I was probably two blocks away from the World Trade Center site. And I see this guy come walking out of the smoke, and it was Don Riley, who was a Suffolk County a DA investigator who I'd worked with on a racketeering case. And he's like, "Jeff," you know, it was like just two of us. This is what cops do, right? There's a problem, there's a shooting. You walk to the danger, you walk to try to help, and that's what he was doing too. So the two, we teamed up with this a female NYPD uniform cop, and the three of us were the first people to get to that North Tower after it came down. And you know, there were bodies all over in the rubble. We gave aid to, there were still some people. There was a guy with who's missing an arm lying in the rubble. You know, we gave him aid and got an ambulance and helped carry him out. And, you know, I spent hours down there just trying to find victims who were still alive and try to help them. And I remember calling back to the office reached out to me on the radio. And they're like, "Where are you?" And I was literally holding a stretcher with a injured firefighter on it, carrying him out of the rubble. And I'm like, "I'm here rendering aid." And they're like, "Oh, well, you're ordered to return to base." And I'm like, "I'm not effing doing it." You know, like, I'm down here helping people. How about you guys come down here and help us, right? But I said, "I'm not doing it." And there's this long pause. And then the agent who was at base, who was relaying this message, was said, "Okay, I'll let him know where you are," you know, because at the heart of it, I mean, this is such a key thing, right? This is what cops do. You know, there's a bad guy out there hurting people. You go stop him. There's people who are injured. You go help them. And this is what drives people. But I mean, that was just this horrific scene. I remember standing there, the tower's down. There's flames coming out of the ground. There's these huge crevices, you know, because I don't know how many stories it goes down, but beneath these towers and beneath these other buildings is complex. But you could look, and there's just holes in the street, and you can look down like hundreds of feet, you know, into the ground. And there was, everything was on fire. There was, a fire truck parked right near the tower that was just covered in rubble. And I remember climbing into it, looking for people. And I got a fire hat on because there was still stuff in the air. And I mean, it was nuts. I stayed down there for probably 6 hours or something, you know, and then at some point I went back to the office. And I remember walking in there, and somebody said I looked like a snowman because I was just covered with the white dust. And I had one of the ASACs who was in charge at the time, because the SAC wasn't there. Yeah, I think he was out suspended because of misuse of his G ride. But we had an ASAC in charge of the office, and I remember him telling me, so I guess you went down there against my orders. And I'm like, "Somebody had to, you know?" And he's like, "Oh, I guess I can't fault you for that, you know?" But there were a bunch of agents who went down there and a bunch of guys who figured they would just fight. But when I was down there at the site, and this sounds so corny, but I swore, I said, "You know what? From now on, I literally said, I'm going to avenge this. And from now on, I am going to use my investigative skills to go after the people who did this and go after terrorism." Like that was, I really did. For the rest of my career, that's all I did. I spent years after that trying to push DEA into counterterrorism. You know, that day, I remember they got us all together in the New York Field Division, and they took, we were all, "Okay, this is our response. What are we going to do?" You know, and they told us, "Go home and we'll call you when we figure out what's going on." And we had hundreds, like there were at least a couple hundred agents in that meeting saying, "Are you kidding me? We want to help," you know? So people went home, and we spent like several days at home when we were told you could go down to help if you wanted to, but you couldn't do it officially. It had to be on your own, and you couldn't drive your car, and you couldn't use your badge. It just had to be you by yourself going down. So a lot of us went down and just helped, like digging through the pile, looking for survivors. And I mean, I don't know if they found anybody in the days after that was alive, but we had a lot of people, just long lines going up into the rubble. I mean, we found body parts, you know, we found bodies, helped drag bodies out from underneath girders and things that had collapsed. And I remember, again, the good people in DEA, right? I remember I drove my work car down there, and I used my badge to get to the site, you know, because you just couldn't otherwise.
You violated another rule. I can see how this is going here, Jeffrey.
Might just be a theme for what we're talking about here.
I would never do that.
I'm wearing my DEA raid jacket, right? Like, and I'm down there and I'm helping out. And I remember I was in walking out of one of these lines to get some water, and I bumped into an OPR agent who was there.
Well, tell everybody, a lot of people, we know what it is. Tell everybody who OPR OPR is and why that is such an important set of acronyms.
So it's the Office of Professional Responsibility. It's basically DEA's Federal Internal Affairs Unit, right? So I'm down there with the DEA stuff on, you know, in violation, doing, trying to help. And but so is this guy, by the way, right? So he's the investigator. So he looks at me and I look at him and there's just this moment between us. And he looks at me and says, you didn't see me and I didn't see you.
There you go.
You know, and then we both went back and we're again carrying body parts out of the rubble. But that's who DEA hires, you know, just people who want to do the right thing. And I mean, law enforcement around the country is like that too. And it wasn't just law enforcement, by the way. Like over those days when we were digging, there were lines of people like electricians and contractors and people who threw their tools in their truck and drove from all over. People from Ohio, people from the middle of the country drove to the World Trade Center to help. I mean, it was the most touching thing I ever saw. I'm talking about hundreds of people lined up waiting to get into the site just to try to help. And this was a nasty site, right? I mean, there's heavy metals in the air. And I mean, it was nasty. But people came to help because that's what Americans do.
Hey, players, that is the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, go check us out at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, go check out our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including our book list. Any book written by our guests will be listed there. In the meantime, go check us out also, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. It's where we put a lot more content you won't hear on our regular podcast. We go into a lot more topics, and folks, it is a lot of fun. So go check us out, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. In the meantime, everybody stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.